How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody. You know, we don't do the shows as often as we used to, which makes me miss all these wonderful people even more. And we have a really terrific, hold on, I have to reach, get my book back. We have a really, really wonderful author tonight, Liza Mundy, who is award-winning, best-selling, very cool person. And she has written The Sisterhood, which is this secret history. It really is the untold history of women at the CIA. It's really kind of 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Fantastic book. And she's probably a spy, too. I mean, we were talking about this. If you were a Patreon, you would know this. But pretty much one out of five people is a spy. So she's probably a spy. But she's great. But first, we have I'm so glad to see Claude doing the important work. Jamie McIntyre from his dark, secure, unsecure location. David Aldridge. And we are so happy to welcome back a member of the family, Anne Hornaday. How are you, Anne?
Hanging in there, Tori.
Welcome back. Thank you so much. It's great to have you here, especially with the big Oscars coming up.
Oh, it's so exciting. I know. I can't wait to chop it up with all of you about it.
You will. And there are so many books featured in this year's Oscars.
It's really true. Yeah, it's a very booky Oscars this year.
Very booky Oscars. Okay, but now I have to ask a sporty question to start things off. David, we haven't had a sporty question for a long time. So I have to ask a sporty question. For my two 20-something young male sons, put in context Caitlin Clark's accomplishment over the weekend.
It's phenomenal. It's, I was thinking of writing this, but I just don't feel like dealing with hate tweets and hate.
Well, don't read them then. Don't read them.
I know I shouldn't. I do. It's stupid of me. It's my fault.
For those watching David Aldridge, in case you think you're involved in spycraft with David, right now his tail is reaching over the back of his head.
Exactly.
The back of his head.
I'm the spy, like the man said in the Star Wars movie. I'm the spy.
Okay. But what would you write? What would you write?
I'm so tired of comparing.
No.
Why do we have to compare Caitlin Clark to Pete Maravich? Or for that matter, to Lynette Woodard, or for that matter, to Pearl Moore.
Right.
Other great players who scored an incredible number of points in different levels of what was at the time the top spot for basketball. And it's like comparing, you know, a pomegranate to a steak. There's no comparison. One's not better than the other. They're completely different. Pete Maravich did it without a three-point line, you know, in 1968. Yeah. But he took 38 shots a game.
But people in the sports world are the ones who started this whole Mount Rushmore thing.
Well, yeah.
Your people started this, David.
Some people.
Some. What I loved about seeing it, and I want to go across the top of my five favorite spies. What I loved about it when it was happening, and she's a remarkable young woman in every sense of the word, and Lynette was there to see it and these kinds of things and stuff. And they all said, you know, records were made to be broken. That's not what matters. It matters what she brought to the game.
Yes.
You know, highest price tickets ever. I hate to make it all about money, but highest price tickets ever for a women's game. People who want to see her break and what the joy that she brings to the game every time she plays. Absolutely. I think that, and I love that all the people to whom she was being compared said exactly what you were hoping for.
Yeah. And what I do like about Caitlin Clark is that she engenders both incredible, you know, there are people who worship her, fly 5,000 miles to see her, all the usual stuff. And there's people who hate her. And I love that. That's when it's the same.
Right.
And there are people that can't stand Caitlin Clark.
Right.
Want her team to lose. That's what happens when great players truly have made it kind of across the Rubicon.
That's a great sign.
That's wonderful. She should be honored that there are people who hate her.
Yeah. Great sign. Anne, thoughts?
Okay. Full disclosure. I'm not a sports. This is where I have to.
We are a non-sporty person friendly environment. It's okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Here's the worst part of that is that I'm from Iowa. So I really should have been all over this, but I so I you know I'm a but then I don't want to be a fair weather fan. Like I don't want to be that guy, you know, who tunes in on the big night and roots for my homegirl. So I was just stuck. But no, I think she's
It's okay.
so I
It's
agree with you
great.
about the joy though, Tori. I mean, just watching her, the times I do trip over my thesaurus and mistakenly turn on ESPN or it's really fun to watch. It's really, really fun to watch. And I totally agree with the electricity and the passion and the fun that she's brought. That's what's so
Yeah.
gratifying.
Yeah, and I'm sure women's sports will go, you know, just the way everything else has gone. But for now, you still find these moments. Claude and I were talking the other night, but I am just obsessed with the latest version of the Professional Women's Hockey League. They just love what they're doing. They're getting paid peanuts, but they love what they're doing. Okay, Jamie, Caitlin, Claude, thoughts?
They say there are no stupid questions, only
That was
stupid
one. I
reporters.
found it.
I'm going to challenge that premise now because I have a stupid question that I'm going to confess it just ran through my brain as I was watching all the highlight reels of
Right.
Caitlin Clark, and which is so David, what would happen if she played in an NBA, just one NBA game?
Oh,
Would she be able to make all those three? She can make those three
Oh.
pointers with like, it just seems like she can throw them in from anywhere. Couldn't she
That's a
do that?
Bobby Riggs question.
I
It
would
is a
say
Bobby. I told you it was a stupid
no,
question.
it's not.
Yeah,
Yeah, well, you didn't tell me it was a misogynist,
it's not
sexist
that it's
question.
not.
No. I mean,
I'm thinking she's so good. Why can't,
Okay. All right. Go.
I would say
Go.
this. The premise assumes that she has to play in a men's game to be have.
No. I'm just saying she's so good. I'm thinking like she, to I'm just watching. I think she
I
can
would
play
say this.
anywhere.
In
I think she's a
today's NBA, in today's NBA, which emphasizes the three-point shot over everything else, there is nothing more important than taking three-point shots. If she was on a team that had multiple players that could make threes and
So they
draw
couldn't gang up on her.
well, right. I mean, but that would be the same with any player, right?
Right.
Like
And
you
then
want
you
to be on
get
a
three
player,
pointers.
you want to be on a team that has three or four guys or three or four players that can all make threes, because then nobody can, the spacing is so, you
Right.
have to guard so much space, you can't guard everybody,
Right.
right? So she could probably play in an NBA game. I don't know that she would be great, but she could probably play for a few minutes. Yeah, she could probably play. I mean,
I told you it
there's
was a
so
dumb question. It's just the kind of thing that went
well,
through my head. Because, when they show those highlights, they never show her missing. So it's
yeah, I
hard to know
mean,
she
it's
never misses.
right.
Okay,
I
Jamie,
mean,
dumb question, but good answer. So you
okay.
prompted a good answer.
All
Okay,
right.
that's good. Claude, thoughts on Clayton Clark, and then we got to move. We got to go.
Oh, no, I mean, look, she's great, right? And what's interesting to me is how great the women's college basketball game is right now at a
Yes.
time when college basketball needs something to make it great. It's not coming from the
Not this
boys,
year.
it's coming from
This
the
year, it
women.
is
No,
all women. It
right,
is
exactly. I mean,
every
you
bit
look
about
at
the women this year. Yes.
Caitlin Clark, you
Yes.
think about Juju Watkins at USC, Angel
Absolutely.
Reese at
Yep.
LSU. I mean, there's some
Yeah.
phenomenal players. I can't name one player on the men's side. I don't know them. I don't know any
No,
of them.
it's a
And some of
very
that is because a
down.
lot of
It's,
guys are
I
one
mean,
and
not
done or two
again,
kids.
not to compare, but the women's game is much more compelling this year than the men's game.
As you were
But
ticking off those players, I just want to note that Anne Hornaday was nodding at each
yeah. She
one.
was.
She's like,
Got a favor.
yes,
Got a
I could
favor.
see what she was saying.
She
Yeah,
follows
Jamie,
them.
you left off nodding sagely. I was nodding sagely.
Yes.
Yes. So true, Claude. So true. I have no idea
Okay.
what any of you are talking about.
Before we leave basketball, so my son Colin will Wake Forest graduate will speak to me. So a few days ago, a really interesting thing happened. Anne's going, why did I show up tonight? Why am I here?
Just wait till we start
So
talking about movies.
several days ago, we're going to turn to it in like 3 minutes, not like in 3 minutes. So a few days ago, there was a basketball game between Wake Forest and Duke. And if you go to any school in North Carolina, which I did, NC State, that's a three-syllable word, go Wolfpack. But you go to any school in North Carolina, you get up every morning, and the first thing you think to yourself is, I hate Duke. I hate Duke. I just hate Duke for multiple reasons. So you always want to beat Duke, but if you're not on the court or on the field against Duke, you want whoever else is to be beating them. So when little tiny Wake Forest beats Duke, that in and of itself is a spectacular thing. And
Yes.
when the cute Wake Forest Deacons storm the court,
and knock down a few Duke players,
Meandering one of them.
it's not a bad. Oh my God, he flopped. David, he flopped. He totally flopped. He was on
They
the
had to
court 2 days
carry him
later.
off the court.
Yes, he totally made up the knee injury that he now has.
Which he then played on vigorously 2 days ago.
You know, he got over it. I didn't say that.
He got over it in 48 hours. He got over it in 48 hours. But I cannot tell you the number. And there were maybe four people that with whom I went to school at NC State or went before I did, these yes. kinds of things. And we check in with each other two or three times a year. And it's usually over a Duke game. We were on the phone for 2 hours a night going, oh, yeah, way to go. Way to go, Deeks.
Two things. I still can't fathom you being at NC State. That just doesn't, I just doesn't compute.
David,
to
it's a three syllable word. Stye. You can't go to college.
I've been to NC Stye. State and I know you, and those do not work.
Oh my God. Are you kidding? I loved NC State. I loved it. It was great. And you know, if you couldn't get in anywhere else, that's where you went. Okay, it was great. Ian, you still with us?
She is somehow.
Oh, I'm muting. Hello. Exit. Yes.
Okay. All right. Ian, it is so great to have you with us for so many different reasons. But thank you for being with us, especially 1 week before the Oscars. And first of all, I have to say this every time I talk to you. Talking pictures, how to watch movies. I've read the book. I've read it three or four times. And every single time I go, okay, it's deepening my appreciation for how hard this business is and how hard it is to make a good movie. And it also makes me feel stupid, which is really easy for a kid who went to NC State, which is the three syllable word. But first of all, let's talk about the Oscars this year. And then it segues nicely into books because it is such a book centric Oscars.
Absolutely. But
this is a good year, right? Give us your
wonderful year. Wonderful year. It was a great year. And as a matter of fact, this is a little sports thing fact. The first movie that I saw last year that made me feel good and like, wow, they're kind of back was Air. I don't know if you guys saw Air about the Air Jordan, the creation of the Air Jordan.
Couldn't watch
I just found
It's not personal. I just couldn't watch it because I know everybody that's involved in it.
You can imagine. It would drive you nuts if you really know the people and the real story. But it was just so entertaining and so just deftly, adroitly done. You know, the entertainment value was so high. And then, the whole year just went on like that. Like, I just kept seeing things that delighted me. And Barbenheimer was really fun, and that injected a whole lot of energy into movie going, and that was just a blast. And then we go into the festival season, which is the sort of precursor to awards, and saw lots of wonderful things there. So yeah, it was just, and I'll tell you, the year before I was not feeling that way. You know, like when I go to make my top 10 list, I usually like to be spoiled for choice, but I remember in 22 thinking, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it to 10. Like that's how disappointed I was by that year. And I can't even remember actually what the big movies were, but I remember not really being in sync with my colleagues on a lot of stuff, like thinking, so this was a wonderful year.
Okay. Question for you. So everything I know about fashion, I learned from Devil Wears Prada, a great movie, which holds up very well.
Yes.
So whatever we see, you know, where I go shopping, H&M, TJ Maxx, is a result of something that happened 2 years before.
Right.
Decisions were made 2 years before. So these great movies that we saw in 2023, and I've seen so many of them, which is highly unusual for me. When were they being made? And does the pandemic have anything to do with the excellence in the work we've seen?
That's a great question that I can't pretend to know the specific answer to movie by movie. Mm-hmm. But here's what, you know, what I do know, the movies that I do know about the backstories of, it took them all a really long time.
Right.
And I think a lot of these were started before a pandemic.
Yeah.
And what I might suggest is that the pandemic actually gave them more time to gestate, which is never bad, right? Like, you know, just having more time is rarely, sometimes it's a bad thing, but, you know, usually it's a pretty good thing. You can make the script better. You can whittle it down. You can refine it. So I think that's a really, that's a, you know, excuse me while I steal that idea.
Interestingly, for reasons not worth explaining why, I know somebody who used to work at Mattel And I recently met him and we're talking about this. And I said, oh my God, you know, what did you think about the Barbie movie? And he goes, love. That idea started 7, 8 years ago.
Oh, definitely. And I know
Took that
Nolan
long.
was working on Oppenheimer for a really long time.
Right.
Alexander Payne, you know, had wanted to do a movie like The Holdovers and then got this
Yeah.
spec script for a series that he then asked the writer to kind of retool for. So all of the, you know, like a, you know, I think I don't really know the, you know, the TikTok of Zone of Interest, but like, no, I mean, I think most of these, yes. Oh, hi. Oh,
Hi.
there's Lisa.
Hi,
Hi.
hi.
Hi,
Hi.
Liza. Hey, Liza,
Hi,
hang
how
on.
are you?
We're talking movies. Okay, hang on.
Oh,
Okay.
good.
So, Ian, what is it with all the book-centric movies this year? So I'm going to get it wrong, but I've got American Fiction, I've got Oppenheimer, and I've got Killers of the Flower Moon, all of which I've read them
And
and
Zone of
like them.
Interest, which was based on a novel. I mean, that's such a fascinating story. But yeah, well, it's not that like Hollywood has always gone to previously produced things like novels and plays. So it's not that, you know, it's not that unique. But again, it was these were just such strong, Poor Things is another adaptation.
Right.
And I just think that it was the unmakeability of them. It's like, how do you make a movie about Ty Bird's American Promethea? Like that doesn't scream feature, you know, big hit summer movie. Zone of Interest, I mean, that was a no novel by Martin Amis that Jonathan Glazer then researched the real life people that it was based on and ended up making a movie that's much hues much closer to the, you know, the real events than I think Amis's book does. So they not only were they, you know, adaptations, but they were really interesting ones, you know, like and yeah, we can talk about Killers of the Flower Moon because I have thoughts and feelings about that.
Okay, I have thoughts and feelings about it as well, which I love the book. Anything by David Grant, I will read. He writes the phone book, I will read it.
Read.
I tried two or three times with Killers of Flower Moon, the movie, and it didn't work for me. Is there a secret to making a good book into a good movie?
Now, yes, it's to make a good movies. And that
God.
it, and I had just read it, and I think, you know, I don't always read, like, I think that was, I still haven't read American Fiction, even though I cannot wait because I love that movie and I can't wait to read the source material. But with I had just read Killers of the Flower Moon, like I had finished it pretty recently when I saw the movie, and I think it was so in my head. And I think what Graham did structurally with that book is just so brilliant. And no spoilers here, but like what Eric Roth and Scorsese did with the movie was they jettisoned that structure. And I think in doing that, they kind of destroyed the suspense because in that first third
Correct.
of the Grand book, the lens is just widening and widening and widening. And that dread and that and the realization is it's just breathtaking. It's so beautifully calibrated. It's such a hugely emotional conclusion. And they just, you know, they don't do that. They decide to just have De Niro's character tell Leo's character what here's what we're doing. And I just that really took me out of the movie. I just was like, why would you do that? And I'm actually watching, I'm finally getting around to watching Peaky Blinders.
Oh, it's the best. Okay, we're
Which
gonna just like
but
jettison
that
the rest of the
guy,
show.
he could have
Sorry,
done
Liza
it.
Mundy. Peaky Blinders is the best.
It's bad, but don't you? So I'm watching it thinking maybe he should have done that script because I think that gets to he knows about
Yes.
gangs and tribal things and community and suspense, you know, and doling out that information in that
Right.
way that just draws you in. And I don't think it happened with Killers of the Flower Moon. It was very
Okay.
disappointing.
I'm going to tread in territory, which is completely dangerous for me because I use words I don't really understand. There was something completely unnarcissistic about Peaky Blinders. It was every. You know, every character had meaning and importance, and it contributed to the greater story. And it really was about the greater story, despite the fact that Cillian Murphy's cheekbones, like,
I mean,
biceps all day long. All day long.
it's just phenomenal. It's phenomenal.
Okay,
It's he's
let's get out of our Oscar buzz story because Liza's going to leave us here in a minute. And best picture, got to be Oppenheimer, right?
to be Oppenheimer. And I think rightfully so. I really do. You know, it's a very strong field. I loved almost every single one of them, but you cannot take away from the achievement of that movie. You know, it's just, It was really, and I have not, I'm not always a Nolan fan. I come and go. I mean, some of
Yes.
his films draw me in and some really leave me cold. And I was there for it. I was engrossed, absorbed. I just thought it was brilliantly constructed, acted, filmed great. It's just all of it. I don't have a thing. My only criticism, and it's the same thing with him, which is he has a tendency to play music under dialogue.
Oh,
If you know what
interesting.
I mean, like that, he'll underscore a dialogue
Interesting.
scene. And when you have a Cillian Murphy or a Robert Downey Jr., leave them alone. Like
Don't need it.
let the guys talk. That's my
Yeah.
only quibble. But other than, I just thought it was a magnificent achievement.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Okay, David, before I forget, I noticed also over the weekend, Steve Kerr, my future trophy husband, highest
Yes.
paid coach in the NBA.
That's correct.
That's going to make our next life really nice.
You're gonna really enjoy being married to him.
Really
It's gonna
enjoy.
be
Okay.
a good life for you, I think. He's funny.
Okay.
He's really funny.
We got to move on. Liza Mundy, thank you for joining
Can't
us.
believe Liza's still here. I think I would have left personally. I would have left 20 minutes ago, but you stayed.
I did wonder if I had signed on to the wrong Zoom
Often
link.
happens. Often happens. Thank you so much. We go down several paths, and we really think there should be chatter on movies, chatter on, it just goes on and on. But thank you so much for joining us.
If you showed up at Tori's house for dinner on the wrong night, she would just have you in. She would just
Absolutely.
come in and she'd find
Absolutely.
something.
We just
So,
hang pork chop out in the front door and
yeah.
everybody comes on in. Okay, so Liza Mundy, The Sisterhood, The Secret History of Women at the CIA is fantastic.
Thank you.
You have written at least four books. You've won so many awards. You've New York Times bestseller. I hate to sum things up, but I will sum it up. Meticulous research and great storytelling. So before we launch into The Sisterhood, we love the backstory at Chatter on Books. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up? What did you want to be when you were five? And did you read Harriet the Spy when you were younger?
I did read Harriet the Spy.
Yay.
I read a lot of the Nancy Drew books.
Yeah.
I grew up in Roanoke, Virginia.
Nice.
I was a, introverted reader as a kid, and I have wanted to be a writer since I was in high school. What was the rest of the question?
Wait, why did you let's go back to what did you want to be when you were five?
Oh, and when I was five, gosh, I don't know that by the time I was five, I had conceived a notion of what I wanted to be. But certainly I was immersed in probably fairy tales at that age, although
Ooh, that's good.
I would really read anything that was in the house. I would read Reader's Digest that my parents got. My brother got Boy's Life because he was a Boy Scout and that had great adventure stories in it. And so I was an indiscriminate reader for sure. And I remember reading Peck's Bad Boy in my grandparents' basement. And I remember reading my grandmother's old zoology notebooks from college. It wasn't until many, many years later, really when I was writing Code Girls, probably that I realized how unusual it was that my grandmother had gone to college. Like I always took for
Yeah.
granted that the women in my family had gone to college. Both of my grandmothers went. Only one of them graduated because my other grandmother left to get married, which was really common at the time. So she just attended for a year or two, but still, and my mom went to college and my aunt. So that's sort of neither here nor there, but I do think about it a lot because I did take it for granted that that was normal and it really wasn't. It was unusual.
It was very unusual. Let me go across the top. Anne, you as a young reader, what was the influence for you?
Harriet the Spy for sure. I'm a Harriet the
Yeah.
Spy person all the way. That was formative for me. And it was not just formative. I mean, just the personality, just the
Totally
fact that
out
she's
there.
not dependent on approval, or I mean, it really affected the way that I walked through the world at that time. It was just hugely. And like Liza, we took Reader's Digest. Here were the magazines. It was Time, National Geographic,
Yeah.
and The New Yorker, which was classically edited for people like me in the Midwest, you know, reading about stuff in New York without a, you know, hope of getting there, but just loving the writing. So
yeah,
both of my formative texts.
I remember Perry the Spy when I was young, and I didn't know what the word meant, but I knew it was cool. She wore dungarees.
Right.
Like, that's cool. That sounds like something my older sisters, who I hated even at a very young age, did not wear. And I thought that was very, very cool.
Okay. You know, they say that if you mispronounce a word, you shouldn't be embarrassed because that means you picked it up reading.
It's one of those. Okay. So tell us how you got to, I mean, this seems to be your specialty now, the code breakers, the sisterhood, you know, as you go on through your life and your career, which has been incredible, and you've written for every, you know, major publication in the world. What made you focus in on women in this category? And by the way, as you go across the top of the screen, I don't know how your screen looks, but we've decided you and David, Claude, Jamie, Claude had to go somewhere. Me, somebody's a spy. It's just the numbers of those numbers. So somebody's a spy. But what got you interested in this particular genre of people, of women out there in the work world?
Well, with Code Girls, I had an editor who just floated the idea, and it must have been 2012 or 2013. It was before Hidden Figures had been published, or you know, the current really flurry of books about women in American history contributing in ways that they hadn't gotten credit for. But I had an editor who just said, I think that readers are looking for narratives about women as agents of history. And I had that idea in my head, and I started, it took me a while to try to find that. And I was referred to a declassified history that had been written by an NSA historian about the NSA's Russian code breaking project that started during World War II, even though we were not supposed to be listening to and breaking Russian messages, Soviet messages during the war, because they were our allies, but we were. And so it was this declassified history of what became known as the Venona Project. And and those messages, many years later, it was discovered, contained the names of Americans and British officials who had passed secrets to the Soviets during the war. So that's why those messages were very difficult to break, but they were very important. And anyway, this historian, whose name was Lou Benson, was before his time in that he noticed that the majority of the code breakers working on the Russian project were women, and that a lot of them were school teachers from the South, and that one of the primary code breakers, Jean Grey Beale, was from far southwestern Virginia, more in the sticks even than Roanoke, where I'm from. And she had been a school teacher, and in 1942, she was recruited to work on the wartime code breaking project. And so when I saw that, and she was no longer alive when that was declassified, but he had thought, well before any historians considered women participated in World War II code breaking, at least on this side of the Atlantic, to be worthy of notice. He had interviewed her and a number of her female colleagues, all of whom were former school teachers from the South, from Texas, from Virginia, from North Carolina. And so, again, like this, these people could have been my grandmother or my mother. They went to liberal arts colleges, or they went to teachers' colleges. They were young women. They were single school teachers. And all of a sudden, what? They were, you know, whisked to Washington to learn how to break Russian code systems. So I went out to the National Cryptologic Museum, which exists in Maryland, adjacent to the NSA, but it's open to the public.
Spectacular.
And I talked to an NSA historian, a woman, and a curator at the museum, a woman. And it was as though they had been waiting for somebody to come along who was interested in this topic. And they sat with me for a couple of hours and laid out the much larger story of not just these women who were working the Russian project, but women who were working the German and Japanese code systems and those of many, many other countries during the war. And as they laid it out. And I didn't know anything about cryptanalysis. I didn't know anything about code breaking. And I certainly was no expert in World War II. I've been to Normandy. But I couldn't believe that it hadn't been written already. Right. And then it turned out that it hadn't. And so I, for that book, I had to figure out whether it would be possible to find any of these women who would be in their early 90s, and then whether it would be possible to find paper records of what they had done, because if I could find them, they would be recalling work they had done 75 years earlier. Right. And so that took a couple of years to answer that question.
You did find some of them, and you found incredible records.
Yeah.
No, I was getting ready for this. Yeah. There are multiple stickies in my book. I just thought I can just start reeling off names or categories. But Lisa, I'm in love with Lisa. I'm in love with
Lisa. Oh, good.
I'm in love with Shirley. I'm in love with all these people.
So I am in love with all of them also.
You found some real people who are still alive, and you found the records as well, right?
Right. So that was for Code Girls, that I had to find women who had been code breakers and then find the records in the National Archives that supported it and that they did exist. And then, so after Code Girls was published, I heard from at least 20 more women in their 90s who had done the work. And I heard from so many adult children who knew that their mothers had done something during World War II and thought that they might have been code breakers or in espionage. And so there was a parallel cohort of women, and Julia Child is the most famous, who were recruited into the Office of Strategic Services. So I had always been interested in this other cohort of women who were pioneering our espionage efforts during World War II. So that's part of what led to the sisterhood, this parallel cohort of women who weren't breaking codes, but who were spying and analyzing the intelligence gathered during World War II and really laying the foundations for the CIA. And then I had always been interested in, well, what happened to these women after the war? What was the Cold War like for women who stayed on with these agencies when we retreated from the inclusion that that was sort of a desperation measure during World War II, and sort of attempted to, you know, put the toothpaste back in the tube or the genie back in the bottle and send women back home. And that's where I discovered the stories of Lisa Harper, who was recruited into the CIA in the late mid-1960s, and Shirley Sulik, a wife who served, and the stories of the women's contributions during the Cold War, which was this existential struggle between America and communism, and spying was such an important part of that. And women were certainly discriminated against and belittled and marginalized, but in part because they were so invisible, it made them very successful.
Liza, can you talk? Let's just pick on Lisa for a minute. I mean, there are so many women featured in this book.
I know.
Fantastic. And Anne, I want to hear from you, because when I read these things, I think to myself, it is like Hidden Figures. I mean, these women, we don't know their stories, but they contributed so much to the importance of spycraft, et cetera. But Lisa is such a good example of someone who, if there is DNA, she had the DNA. And if she was raised and educated, so talk a little bit about her as an example of this, because she faced all the challenges, discrimination, but in your own words,
she faced a classic Cold War era, Mad Men era quandary, in that she was recruited by the CIA in 1966, graduate of Brown University, fluent in Chinese and French, in several other languages. She had grown up the daughter of an American diplomat abroad, very comfortable in foreign cultures, but more fluent in French than in English, because she had spent her girlhood in Paris, where her dad was stationed. And so she was just highly desirable to the State Department, but also to the CIA. And she knew what the CIA was, and she knew what it did, because her dad had also served in Vietnam, and she had gone over there as a young girl, and she, knew who some of the spooks were there. So she knew what the clandestine service was. She knew the kind of work that she wanted to do. She wanted to do spy work overseas, undercover, talking people into handing secrets over to the United States. And that job at the CIA it goes by the bland name of case officer, but that's the James Bond fighter pilot, most prestigious job you can have at this huge, you know, agency. And it's just, it's a small and elite cohort of people. That's what she wanted to do. And they promised her she could work in the clandestine service. But when she said yes and signed on and went to train, they tried to steer her into the conventionally female path of being a desk job, being what was called a reports officer. That's the Miss Moneypenny role. And and she didn't want that. I mean, it's an important job, but that's not where her talents lay. And so she pushed back. So they yanked her out of training. But it was when she got married that she was forced to actually resign in order to follow her spy husband overseas. And this was true of women at the CIA. This was also true of women in the State Department. And when I give this, when I give talks about this now, like I get these blank looks from people in the audience.
Shocked.
Looks
people
of disbelief. Like they're like, wait, what? She had to resign. And that was just the norm. And there was actually, I've learned since the book was published that there was a word for this. You were, if you were a wife, you were considered an immobile. That was the term. You were not mobile. It was assumed that you could not travel for your own assignments because a spouse, a husband would never follow a wife, but it was a wife's responsibility to follow her husband. So Lisa became a trailing spouse. Her career, it looked like, had ended, her own career. And she, but then she was called into service to do jobs for her husband and for the CIA stations overseas, moving under what was called housewife cover. That was a little term. They would
actual spycraft. It was actual spycraft.
Yeah, she was spying. She just wasn't.
Right. I want Lisa to give a couple examples, and then David's appropriately drinking more from his wine, because I was going to throw it to Anne next, but I won't. I'm going to throw it to Jamie and then David to respond to this. But it had that horrible misnomer, but she was doing actual important spycraft.
Absolutely, because they would send her out under housewife cover to communicate with assets.
HC for short, Lisa? Was it called HC for short, I hope?
Oh, HC for housewife cover. Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. And she had received some training and she was very good at it. So she was essentially working unpaid, and the U.S. government expected two for the price of one for decades, really. And she was so happy to be able to do the work. She loved the work so much that she accepted basically the scraps that she got. It was the assignments that were in the middle of the night and it would be rainy or cold. And it was somebody who had a secret who nobody else in the station wanted to meet with them. So they would send Lisa out and she was expected to do it. And her husband would be evaluated based on how effective and cooperative his wife was. So that was the Cold War era, Mad Men era approach to spycraft and also to diplomacy. And I gave a talk at a gathering in Washington where there were a lot of women who, including the U.S. ambassador on who this new movie is or series is based, The Ambassador. And all the women were nodding. Yes. This was what women were up against. And this is what wives were up against during that era, that if you wanted to be a State Department officer or if you wanted to be a CIA case officer, you had to stay single.
OK, Jamie McIntyre, longtime national security correspondent, respond and address.
I'm not shocked, but I'm appalled. You know, I'm well aware of how this has changed over the years and how difficult it was. You know, I shared a picture the other day of, you know, in the Pentagon they have a wall of all the correspondents, right? They have pictures of all the Pentagon correspondents. And one day, and it was like 1994, I took a picture of the pictures on the wall, and I came across it the other day, and I shared it with some of my colleagues, who many of them are now retired. And of course, the thing that that stuck out when you looked at it in retrospect was these were all men. These were all white men.
Yep.
The exception of Suzanne Schaefer of the Associated Press, who by the way, went to the National War College as a reporter.
Yeah. Probably a spy.
I think Suzanne would probably be a better person to respond to this than me.
David, thoughts, comments?
Well, I mean, I wish I could say I was surprised, but I'm not. I mean, come on, this is fairly typical. I'm sure it was even worse for women of color and, you know, LGBTQ women. It was 10 times worse. I did want to ask you, I was fascinated by, and it's so ingrained in our culture to just assume things that are stupid and not true. I had no idea until this book that the person who wrote the memorandum Bin Laden determined to attack in the U.S. was a woman. That no, because I'm stupid. Because I'm a dumb.
Why would you?
Stupid at all.
Yeah. Well, I was fascinated by that whole time frame of those women that were on to Bin Laden before anybody else and never, and still didn't, not only did not get the credit, they got blamed after 9/11 when they said, well, wait a minute, we're telling you that this guy's dangerous.
Right. But there's no reason that you would have known that the author was a woman or that the primary author was a woman, because they're all published under, you know, they're considered what's called corporate products, that they're not signed. It wasn't signed by her. So how, and that was one, that's, well, I guess, that's one of the difficulties for the female analysts, in that if you want to publish something, you have to get all these people to sign off on it because it is a corporate product. It would be like when I was at the Washington Post, it would be as if I would have had to persuade every colleague and every editor in the building to run my story because it was not going to be published under my byline, but, you know, by the whole Washington Post. Yeah. And that's what they were up against. So they were trying to get their voices heard in a bureaucracy where you needed clout and you needed to be well-networked to get these other desks to agree. So Barbara Stude was steeped in this the history of Al-Qaeda, and she was the one who was called upon to write that memo. Well, but there was no reason why you would have known that, because they're not bylined.
Well, you know, right? this recent horrific attack in Israel by Hamas on October 7th, the Israeli intelligence officer, and I may have her title slightly wrong, but the one who put together a report warning is the top leadership in Israel that Hamas was planning this attack with all the details of exactly how it was going, was a woman, and her product was ignored, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Right. And even when she insisted, she was told, well, this is an aspirational scenario. And there was also a team of an all-female team of spotters who were assigned to sit at computer monitors and study the Gaza border, activities on the Gaza border. And they, too, were warning of signs of, you know, unmistakable signs of preparation for an invasion. And one of them was told, you know, it's not your job to just sit there and watch the screen. It's not your job to analyze this and tell us. And it's true that, you know, that an ordinary soldier could also be told that, sort of, you know, just sit down and shut up. But one of them was specifically told, you know, women are not able to be analysts.
Okay. Ann Hornaday, you would think right now you're sitting there thinking about the Iowa basketball, because you're so deep in Iowa basketball. And you're thinking, Tori's not going to call on me on this, but I am, because I'm thinking about Zero Dark 30. And I realize that when you make a movie, there's a lot you've got to leave aside, and you're trying to tell a story and you're trying to make a point. But one of the points they were trying to make in that was the role of a woman.
Absolutely. She was a composite of all those women that I'm sure Liza knows them very well, as was Jennifer Ellie. She was based on a very real woman in a very real situation. And, you know, it was so interesting. I was listening. There was an NPR story, I think yesterday or the day before, about the history of women being editors in Hollywood. Like, it was just a traditionally female role. And one of the women that they interviewed, they were asking her, why do you think that is? She said, well, you know, maybe it had something to do with sewing, you know, like that women were associated with being able, and it was not thought of as an autorial practice. You know, it was more of a craft, like an artisanal, almost menial, right? Like, here, go put this stuff together. And kind of denigrated for, and I wonder the same thing about these women in intelligence. Like, they were sort of dismissed within the institution, but they were certainly recruited. You know,
exactly.
They were there for a reason. And so right. It's like, what do you think were the traditional female stereotypical values that went into that judgment?
Right. There was the belief that women were good at certain tasks and not good at other tasks, so that women were good at detail and sort of painstaking, careful work, not the most prestigious, therefore, but the Miss Moneypenny job, the you know, keeping at first typing correspondence in the days of secretaries. And they wanted sort of Seven Sisters, women who had graduated from Seven Sisters schools, you know, elite, nice looking young women to be the secretaries. And also what we forget is that when intelligence is collected overseas, it has to be sent back to headquarters and on paper, and then it has to be kept track of. All this valuable intelligence about people and KGB officers or Soviet scientists, like, and so that was kept for decades on 3x5 cards. Like the CIA headquarters was just like a giant repository of 3x5 cards. And so the belief was that women were good at this too. Women were good at filing and, you know, constructing systems and keeping track of relationships and knowing who was who. So if you were a case officer operating in Moscow and you were thinking about recruiting a member of the KGB, you would contact one of these women back in headquarters. They were called vault women. And you would say, can you tell me about this particular officer? And there was a legendary woman in the vault named Ruth. And she would send you a 6-page memo telling you everything you needed to know about this person, who he knew, who his father was, if they worked for, you know, if his father was with the KGB, and what scientists he was in touch with, and how you might, what might be his vulnerabilities or its interests or stuff. So That was the kind of job, the desk job and the vault and the records and the archives were what women were believed to be good at. But it was believed that women couldn't, I think it was the same as in Wall Street or law firms, that women couldn't be rainmakers and deal makers, that they couldn't operate overseas in a dangerous undercover environment and ask people to commit treason, because that's your job. You're overseas in Moscow or you're in Africa, and you want a foreign national to pass you secrets that their government is not giving the United States. And so you can do this by paying them. You can do it by providing their kids with schooling, or their parents with a better house, or appealing to their dissatisfaction with their own government or their own job. And it was believed just that women couldn't close that kind of a deal, and that women wouldn't be taken seriously in male-dominated countries, which was, during the Cold War, every country.
That was not necessarily, I want to, I mean, the photographs in the book are great. And I admire anyone who gets photographs in the book, because if you've ever dealt with a publisher, you know how hard that is. I love the books. I love the captions. And there's a great line accompanying one of the photographs, and it's true throughout the book, which Jamie has taught me I need to name many, many times. The Sisterhood, the Secret History of Women at the CIA. Female spies have traded not on their sexuality, but on their perceived insignificance.
Right.
Really good female spies knew nobody thinks I'm doing this. Whether it was, you know, Shirley Sulik in her fur coat, they think, oh, they're housewives. They're not doing anything, and they use that, right?
Right, exactly. Shirley Sulik was the black wife of a white case officer. She served with him in Moscow in 1980s, 1990s, and she would move around and she would participate in what was called tradecraft. If a Soviet asset, a member of the KGB who was passing secrets to the CIA, left a message, she carried a huge purse and she would drop a lipstick or a pen or something out of her purse. And, you know, who's going to pay attention to that? She's just a wife. Right. But she would sweep up the message and, you know, and contribute in all sorts of ways. So it was this perceived insignificant, the more insignificant you were seen as being, the more effective you could be moving around, particularly in places like Moscow, where the KGB was surveilling anybody they suspected of being a CIA officer.
Okay, so, Anne, going back to our childhood and Harriet the Spy, we could do this. I could do this.
I was telling Liza before you joined, I was telling the gang that I went to Smith. I was, you know, so
these
home
are your
of Julia.
People.
These are my people. Yeah. But by the time I was there in the 80s, and by that time, the CIA was banned. from Kansas.
Yes.
And that was not uncommon at that point. And for, you know, for understandable reasons. I mean, but I was telling Tori, in another world, at another time, I would have been right there. You know, just it just sounds so fascinating. But here's my question. Has your book been optioned yet? And who's going to play Lisa and all these wonderful women? And who would you want? Who, when you cast
great question. It has been optioned. It, that hasn't been announced. It's going to be announced this week. So I don't think I can say anything right this minute other than that. I don't know if this is taped or what.
But you've got to come back, Lisa, because the potential, I mean, there's so many great characters in that book. You know, Julia Child has become almost the, you know, the stereotype or the caricature of a female spy, but there are so many more subtle characters, which are
great.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Let's not forget Josephine Baker also. She was, there were celebrities, Hedy Lamarr, but Josephine Baker smuggled messages out of France and written on her sheet music in invisible ink and helped the French resistance in any number of other ways. So she's a wonderful story also.
It is so great. And again, across it now, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 people. Well, Claude's left us, but six, it's probably Claude is the spy.
Claude's the spy. Everybody knows. Obvious.
Okay, Liza, we're going to make you do a couple things. You're going to help us launch this thing that I'm calling Go Local on Chatter on Books, because we are all about independent bookstores, local libraries. We have all talked, David has talked, Jamie, we've all talked about the importance of libraries in our life. And you and I traded emails earlier today, but just chat up a little bit about your favorite library, independent bookstore, and then we'll take it to a conclusion. But tell us what you were telling me earlier today.
Yeah, I was gonna beg you to don't make me choose, because I love
you have to choose. You have to.
I have to choose. And so in that case, I want, because I'm such a fan of independent bookstores and libraries as a, you know, as guardians of free speech, as, you know, fierce guardians of free speech. Librarians are such fierce advocates for books and freedom of speech. And you know, as a kid going to the children's library in Roanoke, Virginia, that was a lifeline for me. We didn't have a lot of books in my house. And so as a parent going to Arlington Public Library in Virginia, researching Code Girls, Arlington Public Library had local history section, and that was so helpful. But when I was getting started at City Paper, Washington City Paper, where I started my career, we had these crummy old offices, but they were right next to MLK Library, Martin Luther King Jr. Library in downtown Washington, which had the Washingtoniana room at that point. And that was like heaven. I mean, it was incredible. It was an incredible resource for the local decent paper. Yeah, I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, there was somebody who worked there. You could ask him any question about DC history, and they had all of the old Washington stores in Washington. So I just, you know, I'm enthralled to all local public libraries and independent bookstores. So since you're making me, I'd also like to, and I think anybody who lives in DC, if this is local, could make a trip to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to Midtown Scholar, which is a wonderful, big independent bookstore. It's sort of like the Powell's of the East Coast, because they have contemporary titles, but they also have older titles. And I think they have used books as well. It's this gorgeous space. And I spoke there for Code Girls, and they had me back for the Sisterhood. And I just, it's a great day trip from DC if you're looking to get out into beautiful countryside in order to visit a beautiful.
Right up Route 15. And just shoot right up, take a right, you're there. I've been there. It's a great place. Okay. And if, hypothetically speaking, but it's more than hypothetically, Chatter and Books was going to make a, say, $750 donation to a local, what would it be?
I would ask for MLK Library because of the valuable service that it has provided me in my career and in adulthood, and because of the community that it serves.
Excellent.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay, Liza Mundy, the book is The Sisterhood, The Secret History of Women at the CIA. It is fantastic. It is meticulously researched. It is, the storytelling is absolutely riveting. I'm with Anne. I cannot wait for this has turned into something. Cause I, as I was reading, I just kept thinking, oh my God, this person would be great for this. And this person would be great for that role. So thank you for writing it. B, come back. We want to be invited to a premiere someday. So someday
okay.
We'll be
okay.
There. But hang on for a second. We got to do a little bit of housekeeping here. So we're back in a couple of weeks, everybody, with James Grady, who wrote 6 Days of the Condor. And you probably know this. The original book was 6 Days of the Condor, which got turned into 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford.
That's right. One of the great Washington Redford.
Sorry, yeah. That's like, yeah. it's like number three on my all time movie.
Oh, yeah.
Best movies ever.
Well, David and I are putting our heads on our hands.
I am going to totally fanboy off of this. This is insane.
Oh, well, Jim Spaddy, he's a great storyteller too. You're going to have a really good time.
David, so far, and this is just based on email exchanges, he's rivaling Steve Kerr. I'm just telling you.
He's got company.
I'm
going to let him know.
Yeah. And by the way, he lives in
you, Victoria Clark.
Thank you. He lives in Montana, which
is even better for you.
So we got him back next week, which will be spectacular. I'm sorry, his book, it's called Smoke Is in Your Eyes. It's love, revenge, all sorts of fabulous things. In the meantime, everybody listening, thank you for listening. Patty, Claude and I are going to come find you because we think you were the original Patreon patron, which we appreciate. But in the meantime, go out and buy this book. You guys, there are lots of great reasons to go out and buy books. And then lots of great people to buy books for. The Sisterhood is really spectacular by Liza. Liza, thank you for joining us. David, Amy, Anne, great to see you, my friend. Anne, I'm going to call you.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
It's been great. And most importantly, everybody who's listening, thank you. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.